It is Saturday, September 7th, 2013. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio, 88.9 and KOSP.org. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. My name is Lyle Troxel, and with me in the air room is Bonnie Jean Prim. She's a mediator and broadcaster. Hi, Bonnie.
My eye.
Your eye?
I just thought I'd throw that in there.
All right. And Brian Young, he's an iOS developer, a U and UX developer, a virtual lighting designer. If you don't know what that means, look at it a couple episodes ago. And currently unemployed. That means looking for work. So if you like what Brian talks about, you can hire him away from our show where he's not getting paid, as we all are volunteers here at KSP. Well, sorry to tell you that, Brian.
By the way. We're going to be earning our paycheck today.
You might get lucky and I'll buy you lunch. Maybe. So, Bonnie, let's get into prototyping.
Yeah, so there was a Boing Boing hackathon recently. They had a little festival. And as you know, Boing Boing is my sole source for technology news. Anyway, at this hackathon, one ingenious idea that came up was just a fairly simple method of making sure that nobody gets overheated and dies in a car. No pets, no children. And it involved keeping track of the temperature, and when it got to a certain point, turning on a fan.
Wow, a novel idea.
Pretty simple. But with this doodadery that they came up with, this prototype, there'd be a way to sort of text the driver of the owner of the car, like, hey, things are getting kind of, or roll down, or bzzz, like roll down.
I can imagine next time I'm in France, I leave my car in the San Francisco airport.
Yeah.
I get texts, by the way, your car's overheating and the fan's turning on.
Yeah.
So by the time I get back, no more battery. And that's the thing that's concerning to me about that idea is that at some point, you're going to have a problem where you're cooling the car and doesn't matter that it's being cooled. But this is cool. This is the kind of...
It might be like an on-off switch that comes with it.
Yeah. I can imagine that, you know, that way you feel better about leaving your infant in the car. It's got a fan.
What would be sinister is if you could get a text that says, hey, your car's overheating. We've turned the fan on. You're like, oh, could you turn that off, please? You could do that right from your text. You could still...
I think it makes sense. More smart devices make a lot of sense. And of course, a car already is full of computers. It already has fan systems, and just adding a little more tech
to communicate with each other.
I think you just add on top of that a solar panel of the vehicle that powers the fan, and you're set. Right?
There you go. Improvements.
Cool. So this is all the prototyping story from Boing Boing.
Yeah.
Because they did kind of a prototype-a-thon. I mean, what's the?
Well, they had, and it looks like it was a first event called Ingenuity. And it involved it was a data-driven hack day.
Yeah, hackathon. Okay, cool.
I think within a weekend of activity.
I love those kind of things. Much fun to
participate. Yeah, so they've been releasing a bunch of interesting designs that have come out of that hackathon.
I've been coding away this last week.
I'll do
a story real quick. Yeah, I'm working on an app for my work and for Google Glass. Mm-hmm. And I've been doing a lot of JavaScript programming, which is my kind of day job now. The last week... pretty intensively.
Yeah.
And I'm teasing because I haven't released it yet. I'll be probably releasing it before next week's episode of Geek Speak. So I'll make the announcement on the air and all that. And you guys can try it. But it's basically a photo sharing app for Google Glass so that when I meet people later, I can tell them to go to this website and they can see the pictures of them meeting me with Google Glass.
Now, won't it just seriously be just a bunch of pictures of you smiling? Because you keep handing your Google Glass to other people and then like saying, take
that's
a picture.
That's basically what it is. But now I've learned over the three
Here's
months of having
a picture of me, everybody.
And it's always me making a strange gesture with my hands in the face. You know, there's a lot of pictures of that. But the other thing I've noticed, I've changed my pattern of showing. If you run into me in Santa Cruz, I'm in Santa Cruz a lot. If you run into me in Santa Cruz and you see a guy, and kind of geeky guy, in his late 30s, with Google Glass
chops.
On, with chops
glasses,
in Santa Cruz, just
chops.
Say, "Hey, are you Lyle?" And I will show you Google Glass. I'll demo it for you. You can try it on. It's a lot of fun. I've probably done it to over 600 people and showed them it. And
now, how often do you sterilize those glasses?
I do clean them. Okay. And I was trying to find out what to use. Right, I finally went with rubbing alcohol.
Yeah.
Because I know that's pretty good. I didn't want to damage the rubber.
Half and half. That works.
That's exactly what it did. Diluted it. And then at first I was using vinegar, which was fine, but then I just didn't have some. Okay. Any case, I put Google Glass on someone's face and then I walk them through the steps to take a photograph, which is a voice command thing. Mm-hmm. What I also do at this point, because I'm so good at my script on how to do this, I also pull out my phone, which now is an Android phone. Oh, I've switched since last episode of Geek Speak, I think. Uh-huh. I've switched to an Android phone and I take a picture of them as well with the glass on it. And then I hand them my little card. Cool. So I got a full cycle there. And then later they can find those two pictures on this app that I haven't finished yet. So, Oh, well. Anyway, that's the kind of update on what I'm doing at work and programming and all that. And, of course, it's an open source project, so people can download it and do it their own selves and all that. But
should we go over what all of us are doing for work?
Yeah, why not? Yeah, what are you doing? You mediating?
Nothing. There's no technology.
No? Nothing?
No, nothing.
Okay.
I'm learning about project
you
management
You set yourself
software.
Up for that.
I did.
Yay. Sure, sure we'll get angry emails now.
How about Brian? Are you like
working well, Brian's not working either. He doesn't have a job.
My job is looking for the job.
Yeah.
Right, but isn't it also just kind of making sure that you're up on the stuff? Like, that's a thing, right?
Yeah.
Technology's fast-moving industry. And
is that part of the job? I thought that's just fun.
Yeah. Okay, well, see, there it works out.
So what are you doing besides doing interviews and stuff right now? You worked on app a while ago, an iOS app.
Well, I've got a long-term project I've been working on.
Yeah.
It was my app that I'm using to learn all the iOS technologies. And
you'll release it at some point, but we won't talk about it directly right now. I like the teasing idea, by the way.
The teasing show.
It's especially good if you get back to it at some point.
Oh, we will.
Okay.
All right. So iOS developer, JavaScript developer, and Bonnie's not doing that.
I'm developing people's communication skills.
Nice.
That's a technology, I suppose.
So what's the government doing?
Well, yesterday we had another revelation in the series of revelations from the Snowden releases, leaks, however you would like to characterize it.
Yes.
And
the NSA debacle is kind of what I like to call it.
So there was a lot of, the articles were in the New York Times and ProPublica, and there's a lot of stuff in there that sounds pretty darn scary. So reading through the articles, they talk about how the NSA has been doing for years now, a decade or more, doing things to weaken our encryption infrastructure for the web and to be able to get around all of the encryption that we use every day when you log into Gmail with your TLS or SSL encryption.
Yes.
And all the other different technologies that are just part of the web to make it work for us. So when you read through the articles, they don't give you many details. In fact, they say that they have redacted some of the information just because they were trying to be responsible. But they claim that the NSA can get around quite a few of these technologies, and there are lots of quotes about how gobsmacked various agencies in other governments that the NSA works with were when they learned about what the NSA could do. So there's a lot of talk about this through the geek community, and I just wanted to bring it up because for a layman, there's no way for them to distinguish
what's true and what's not.
Yeah, what's really going on here?
Yeah.
And
well, the part of the story about this is that there's stories that they're brute forcing the TLS encryption protocol. Which is what supports SSL, which is actually the way the web is private right now, the way you can actually do a banned transaction without anybody accessing it. And that's probably not true. It would be a fundamental mathematical discovery to be able to brute force that. And so the concept here is that we have all of these algorithms that define how encryption work are all in the public space. There are academic papers, and there's researchers. So a doctoral candidate will work for years on her paper, and she'll release the paper, and that will be the cutting edge of what encryption is. And that's normally years out before any kind of implementation happens. So for years, people look at that encryption protocol and dissect it and talk about it at convention and stuff, and it's all very heady mathematical stuff. So you have the smartest people on the planet, theoretically, looking at this stuff publicly in open space, the beauty of academia. And the concept here is that the NSA and other secret organizations have that information, but they can also do stuff on their own. And they have a lot of force and a lot of employees working, smart mm-hmm. people working on stuff.
And
they don't like to share that information.
And they don't share their information. The thing that's kind of disturbing to me is that if we have that idea that the government has an organization that works on high academic research but then doesn't have to publish, to me seems really a loss to social knowledge, right?
It does.
It should be in the public space.
They do have a dual mission.
Yes.
Not only are they there to gain access to information for our government, for our country, but they're also there to make sure that we are safe in what we do. So they're there to also increase our encryption abilities. So there are instances that we can point to where they have planted weaknesses into various encryption schemes, but they've also implanted strengthening things. The DES encryption, they submitted to the open source community, they submitted some fixes years ago that nobody quite understood. And it was only years later that people realized how much stronger DES was because of their submission.
Yeah. Yeah, so there is beneficial things happening from the organization as well.
Yeah, it's not a clear-cut case.
But I think what I want to be very clear about is if there was we're not talking about a mathematical, we're not talking about a some organization actually being able to break crypto at the level that we can think of it. They might have some efficiencies that we don't know about. They definitely have supercomputers that can do a lot faster. But when we're talking about the current level of encryption that's going on the internet, no one's breaking that. They're breaking the sides of it. They're wrapping around the details and the nitty-gritty, which gets really complicated. So things like how if you and I privately speak to each other, we can do that great, but if one of us is actually speaking to the government, then it's not a private conversation anymore. And how do you and the protocols only go so far. So then the whole idea that the NSA is putting in spies in their organizations is also kind of creepy, because of course all you have to do is get a few people inside a company that have some rights and you've got a security leak.
Right. So I think the fundamental takeaway here is that the technology that we have for encrypting communication, whether it's through a website or through text messaging, or, cell phone networks are not a good example, but messaging and all the other protocols we have for encrypting, they're solid. They're really good. And when there's weaknesses, the whole community finds out about it.
Yeah.
But those are just weaknesses. They aren't
holes. The thing that's great.
What is not strong is the two ends. Yeah. And at either end, you can do everything from putting a spy in there or social networking sort of attack.
Yep.
Or you can in some way find how the protocol was not used correctly. And, you know, spyware on a laptop can get anything that you
It's
have.
The analog hole, right?
Right.
This idea that if a human being can interact with it, then right between the computer and the human being, just put something there and you've got it. Or put it in the human. No. But the thing that's interesting to me about this whole story is that now people want to get secure. They want to make sure their privacy is enforced. And so the knowledge of the general populace has to get a little better about that. And that's the kind of exciting thing to me as someone who likes to teach technology and like to share. How do we figure out to get people from the place of not knowing about this information at all to knowing a little bit enough to protect themselves? And it's really complicated. As we say, you know, every time on this show when we talk about encryption, we gloss over the details because the details are pages of mathematics, right? It's not like you're going to understand it completely. But conceptually and metaphorically, you can understand some of it. And then you take some trust in some people that are being public and are good about really understanding the math behind it. So I wanted to kind of start a new section on GeekSpeak that kind of starts defining some of these terms so that the general population has some basis to understand it. So today we're going to talk about authorization versus authentication, what the two different things are. We're not going to get into the details. Just authentication and authorization are two different concepts, and we normally wrap them up in one, and we don't really understand either. So we're going to talk about those in a minute on GeekSpeak. So please do stay with us. Also, we have some more geek news, and the second half, your calls with questions and comments about technology.
Hey, if you're enjoying this program, and why would you be? But anyway, you could consider checking out the 7th Avenue Project, which airs Sundays at noon at 88.9, or as a podcast from the talk section of KUSP.org. You guys, it's just a great show. Every week, Robert plucks the bright mind of someone in the arts or sciences and displays the contents in an engaging way for his listeners. And if you aren't one of his listeners already, frankly, you just should be. That's the 7th Avenue Project. It's Thinking Persons Radio with Robert Pauly, and you can hear it tomorrow at noon on KUSP. You can also check out his website at 7thAvenueProject.com.
In fact, what I'm going to suggest you do is go up to GeekSpeak.org. You can see the show notes for the page today, learn all about what we talk about, a little more links, some videos, things of that nature. Mm-hmm. But also on the right-hand side of our page, because we love Robert's show so much. Hey, there you go.
Hey.
All the consonants in the right spot.
Yeah, sure.
There's a link to the 7th Avenue Project and also a couple other things that I think are worthwhile. While you're online thinking about GeekSpeak, why don't you go on to iTunes and give us a rating or go plus us on Google Plus or we don't like us on the faces and all that stuff.
Yeah.
We'd love that kind of input. I'm Lyle Troxell. That was Bonnie Jean Primsch making that little announcement about Robert's show. Hey, Bonnie.
Howdy.
And we also have Brian Young. In the other room, who you can't hear very much on GeekSpeak, probably twice in 10 years, is Rick. And Rick is answering phones in the second half. So in about 15 more minutes, we're going to take calls. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. That phone number is only for the live listening audience. If you're listening to the podcast, email us, geeks@geekspeak.org.
That is a lively and lovely service, by the way. We get mail from
email
throughout the week, and then there's just sort of an ongoing conversation over email.
Yeah, that's right. That's very true.
Yeah.
All right. Authorization versus authentication.
Yeah, wait, what?
Wikipedia to the rescue. There I'm going to read both of them. So first off, let's do authentication because that's definitely the first step in the security privacy thing that we talk about. Authentication is the act of confirming the truth of an attribute or of a datum or entity. Let's say it another way. This might involve confirming the identity of a person or software program, tracing the origins of an artifact, or ensuring that a product is what its packaging and labeling claims it to be. Authentication often involves verifying the validity of at least one of form of identification.
So that's making sure you know the identity of something. Verifying identity.
That's right.
Checking the driver's license of the person that handed it to you.
This is looking at the driver's license and to see if the driver's license matches the person. So the identity thing you're trusting is the driver's license. Yeah. The person's face matches. Maybe some information about them. You ask them their age. They tell you the truth. That kind of confirms that's who they're representing themselves to be.
Right.
Now, this is a really complicated concept on the online world because you are not your name.
Yeah.
You are not your IP address or any kind of identifying system on a computer system.
Yeah, someone else can be using your computer.
That's
someone
right.
Someone else can be borrowing your email.
So I say on the radio that I'm Lyle Troxell, and people go, that voice is Lyle Troxell. There's an authentication there in some level because people recognize my voice.
Mm-hmm.
And that actual personal trust authentication is probably the most reliable in a lot of ways because we as human beings are really good at recognizing people.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's still tricky in the physical world. If you know identical twins, sometimes they can trick you. So authentication is the concept of saying that is who I think it is.
Okay.
And that is the identity.
Right.
All right. Got
now
it?
You got the authorization. What about
okay.
that?
Okay. Authorization. This one's a longer paragraph and is a little more jargony, I think. Authorization is the function of specifying access rights to resources, which is related to information security and computer security in general, and to access control in particular. More formally, to authorize is to define access policy. For example, human resources staff are normally authorized to access employees' records, and this policy is usually formalized as access control roles in the computer system. During operation, the system uses the access control rules to decide whether access requests from authenticated consumers shall be approved or disapproved. Resources include individual files or items, computer programs, and so on. It goes on. Another example. Examples of consumers are computer users, computer programs, and other devices on the computer. So authorization is not about a person, but it's about access to things.
So I believe that you are 21. Thank you for showing me driver's license. You still can't come into the club.
That's right. So that is exactly right. Authentication and authorization normally are so tied together in our concepts, in our minds, that they're hard to decouple. But in a security sense, you really need to decouple them because they are different. They're fundamentally different things.
Mm.
If I know that you're Bonnie Jean Primsch, I still don't know if you can go into this house over here.
I need some other kind of identifier to prove, like a note from the homeowner or something,
right,
to prove that I'm allowed into that house.
That's right. And the other thing that's, the reason why this is so tricky is that we like, the way we think of getting access to things are keys. So if I give you a key to my house, Bonnie,
mm-hmm,
inferred I'm giving you authorization to get into the house, mm-hmm, because I already authenticated you and I feel that you should have authorization to that,
yeah,
house.
And I might be able to have access to your house, but I still can't get into the locked drawer on your desk.
That's right. So I guess that was a bad metaphor because it goes into another part of security. But so authorization and authentication.
Somewhere.
Yeah, I mean the
sorry,
thing.
Everyone.
No, it's okay. It wasn't you. It was actually my example of the key.
But there's
is
levels
really
of authentication.
A way that, yeah, the tricky thing is that the way we grant authorization to somebody,
yeah,
or to something is to understand that that person we're authorizing, the authenticated person,
mm-hmm,
can then get access to something, and we authorize them.
Yeah.
The thing that they're bound very well together. But of course, online, get back into authentication, it's very hard to authenticate a person. And even if you get that authentication and say, yes, this Facebook account now has access to do this, someone else can actually log into that Facebook account using somebody else's authentication, stealing their identity.
Mm.
So that's why these things are so confusingly meshed together in our minds.
Yeah.
How am I doing on explaining this? Brian?
This is working.
Okay. So authorization.
Identity versus access.
Yes. Well, identity versus, yeah, right to access.
Right to access.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
We can, of course, all right. So there's fundamentals, authorization versus authentication. Hopefully that makes sense. If it doesn't make sense, you want some more clarity, or you have a really good example, you're welcome to call us in a few minutes. About 5 more minutes, we'll take your calls. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. And you can ask us technical questions about anything you'd like, and you can ask us about social responsibility around technology, and of course, anything else you feel might be interesting for our feedback. Or you can, of course, share your knowledge with us. We love to get calls from people that have a little more data.
Wisdom of the crowd.
On the talking points. That's right. I've closed up the actual show page notes. I don't know what our next story is. Oh, it looks like it's you, Bonnie.
Oh, well, we could talk about this fancy fun thing I saw online. Elon Musk demonstrating just how SpaceX has used 3D tools to help them design rockets. It's rocket science in 3D.
Yes.
Just totally, totally amazing and like the movies.
Now, are you talking 3D as in you see it in 3D? Or are you talking about 3D in some other sense?
Yeah, 3D as in you see it in 3D, but it's actually in 2D. It's in the design phase, right? Before a prototype has been made. Oh, it's both, actually. It's before a prototype has been made, sort of being able to manipulate it in a 3D way so you can get a better sense of it. And then when you've got it pitch perfect, just the way you want it, being able to print it out on a 3D printer and make a prototype with a 3D printer.
So these are all technologies we've heard of before.
Yeah, but they're combined in a fancy pants new way.
Yeah.
I actually called this on the show page. This is called Future of Design Geek Bit. It's a geek bit because you got to see it. It's a great little video.
Yeah.
And as Brian says, it's very clearly a mishmash of a lot of things that we've been watching and talking about on Geek Speak for years. It's using the Leap, which is a little finger detection tool that knows where your fingers are in space. Part of the example is using the Oculus Rift, which is a 3D goggle interface that makes you blind but then shows you a picture.
Virtual reality headpiece.
Headgear. I had for a while and showed
fun.
People. I showed both of you guys that, right?
Yeah, I saw that.
Also, a projection on glass, which is kind of cool because you can put it in an environment where you can see through it as well. But other than that, it's not really 3D.
It's really for being like the movies. As far as I can tell, that's why they did it.
Yeah.
We'll make Iron 2 happen. Iron Man 2.
And then the other thing in this video that they show is using shutter 3D glasses. These are glasses that you do see in a movie theater where you project two different images onto the same screen, and then you give everybody glasses and you turn on and off the eyes so that each eye only sees one of the images, and they are perspective from each other, so you see a 3D image. That's how perspective 3D with shuttering actually works. And then versus the old school where you actually have two different colors and you filter out the color in each eye, which is not as rich, I don't think.
Yeah.
As someone who doesn't have parallax and doesn't see 3D images, it's really boring to me. But
if you're colorblind, that'd really be it.
Colorblind. Yeah, if I was colorblind too, it'd be totally wrong.
But anyway, on this video, they lay it out just beautifully.
All those things. They're using all of them.
This is kind of amazing. Like, but this is more amazing.
Yeah,
and
it
just keeps getting more and more amazing over the 3.5 minutes or whatever.
And I got to say that I know some 3D modeler people and like animators. Like, oh, Brian, like your wife is a 3D animator. And the tools are always the kind of stumbling block, right?
I mean, this is the really exciting thing for somebody like me, who I've used 3D tools for big studios before, and these are not off the shelf software that you can go out and buy. It's always this very complex, very cutting edge, but not quite polished software that they write themselves. And to see this kind of interface on it is just exciting because, as an artist, going to art school, and then you go out into the job world, and you're using computers, and there's always this big block of glass and this mouse and this keyboard in between you and the art. Mm-hmm. To be able to reach up there and actually grab it, not in a way that you feel with your fingers, but in a way that you see it react.
You can manipulate it
and move
hands.
It around, and to actually see the image on the screen responding quickly enough that you feel like you have that tactile control that you missed back when you used to be a kid playing with pottery or playing with paints, finger painting. I mean, that's what's great about touch interfaces is you've got that actual direct manipulation, and now it's coming to higher-end 3D tools that designers are using for building rockets.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. These tools, I think, are all going to be about how much we can train ourselves to operate that way. My dentist uses a 3D mouse in the office, and that way there's no, because surfaces in the doctor's environment are necessary, filled with other things.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
They've got the staff at his office have a 3D mouse, which is basically a gyroscopic mouse they use to look at and show things to you while you're working. And I've tried it, and I can't get it to work. But they're just flipping through things. Like, it's really easy for them to use because they've trained themselves. I love having a stylus on drawing on a touch surface, right? Like, having a stylus pointer versus my finger
it's
is really important to me.
It makes sense.
Yeah. Any kind of delay fails. It's actually why the stylus on a touch surface, that's why I'm going to Android. That's one of the major reasons.
What do you mean delay fails?
Oh, yeah. If you're drawing on a surface with a pencil, you expect the line
to
be there.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah.
If there's even just a half second delay, then
weird.
All of a sudden you draw and you're like, oh, nothing happened. Oh, wait, there it happened. Oh, no. And now I've messed up my line.
Oh, yeah. It's clunky.
Yeah. And almost all those interfaces, especially early on, are like that. That's what was so neat about the Oculus Rift. The feedback was really, I could not detect the feedback problem.
It felt right. Like it was really there.
Yeah. Until you got nauseous. The phone number the phone number to call in with questions and comments about technology is 1-800-655-5877. Again, nice and slow, 1-800-655-5877. And that, of course, is 1-800-655-KUSP, because it's the radio station. And this is really calling in for people that are listening live. If you're listening through the podcast, email us instead, and sometimes we'll take those.
That's geeks@geekspeak.org.
That's right. Bonnie Jean Primsch is in the air room with me, as well as Brian Young. I'm Lyle Troxell. We'll take calls right after Bonnie tells us one more fun little video to watch. I hope it's on video, or maybe it's just a description.
It's just a description.
Okay. Can you read the description for us?
Yes. It's pretty funny. Let's see. Where did I put it?
Steve Ballmer is actually the current CEO of Microsoft.
For now, of Microsoft. And of course, as you know, there was a deal recently between Microsoft and Nokia. They have been absorbed into the Borg. Now Microsoft owns them. Good luck, Microsoft, because it wasn't working. Anyway, so that's a whole other story. But anyway.
Speaking of someone who has a Microsoft phone.
Yeah, I know. And then there was an incident. Okay, so this is from the New York Times. Mr. Ballmer and Brad Smith, Microsoft's general counsel, were walking across the law firm's lobby when Mr. Ballmer, absorbed in reading a document from Nokia related to the deal, tripped on a glass coffee table. Letting out a loud shriek, Mr. Ballmer fell to the floor, hit his head, and began bleeding above his eyebrow. Executives from Nokia, sequestered in a conference room elsewhere in the offices, were baffled by the sound, wondering whether Mr. Ballmer was reacting badly to a counterproposal that he'd made. Anyway, the security detail patched him up, and Mr. Ballmer resumed negotiations. All was fine, but tee-hee-hee, Ballmer fall down.
Cool. Well, we'll be taking calls. We also got a little story about wearable technology, which, of course, is one of my very exciting things that I love. And Brian's got a story about he's teasing us with, which is wonderful. So we'll go ahead and take... We will not take that call.
Oh,
you hung up on us. All right. If you'd like, you're welcome to call back. The call was from Elizabeth in Aptos. How to watermark photos, good software recommendations.
That's a good question.
So I'm going to answer the one that I'm going to answer because it's easy. I use the app of Adobe product called Lightroom. We had a whole show about it a while ago about photo management and general digital asset management. We have had a few shows over the years because as we get good at taking photographs, because we have the ability to do it all the time with really good cameras, it becomes a real issue on tracking and keeping track of your photos. So I use a large library system for my 200,000 photographs and can manage them, work on them. That's called Lightroom. It actually has a watermarking feature built in. I don't think I've ever watermarked a photo.
You know, we can talk to her directly on line 2, apparently.
She called back. Elizabeth, hi. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. I'm always so relieved when I hear you have, 200,000? Because I'm going right now through my 2,000 or so photos to put them on my website. And
could be worse.
I don't know. Some of them I just think are, you know... Good.
Yeah, I don't have 2,000 good photos. I only have 200,000 photos. About 115 good ones, and other people took those.
They're good enough that people like say, why don't you sell these? You know.
Yeah.
Anyway, I just want to watermark some of them, and I've been using a program that's free that is such a pain in the butt because I really want to do a whole bunch at once, and the program I'm using is like...
What are you using right now to manage your photos? Where are your photos?
Well, that's a whole sorted story. I just have preview, and I've been going through them laboriously, and you know, I didn't change the Lightroom or iPhoto because it would just require a whole thing. So I'm hopefully finishing like you know,
all right,
3 months of going through these. So I don't really want to change to something else.
Okay, so yeah. you're doing it the hard way.
I know.
Yeah, first off, 2,000 photos. How much storage are we talking about? You could make a complete copy of them and try other software. One thing that we don't do very much on computers is have this feeling that we're in control. We have this place where we get where the computer is doing the way it does it, and we train ourselves to work around them. That right there is kind of a failing of the software that we use. It doesn't empower us to be in control the way we should. So one of the pleasures of being a programmer and a hacker is that you start using the tool, you make it work for you versus you work for it. So right now you're using Preview because it's a tool you have on OS 10. You actually have iPhoto, but you're not using it because there's something that doesn't feel right about it. I'm assuming that's why?
I've just never used it. This is the one that my husband's the geek in the yeah. house, and he just sort of said, oh, use this. And I also sometimes colorize them just for fun, and Preview's real easy to do that in.
Yeah, so iPhoto tool has a lot more features and functionality than Preview. So I would highly recommend getting a copy of all your photos and putting them somewhere. Make sure you have two copies of your photos. You've got to have a backup, because if you lose those photos, they're gone, and hard drives die all the time. So first off, make sure you have at least two copies of your photos on different physical things. So if one's on a computer and the other one's on an external computer, another computer, it's good. It's actually also really nice if you don't have it in the same house. That way, if your house burns down, God forbid, you don't lose all your photos. So you got to do that. Do that before you do anything else. All right, moving on, assuming you've done that. If you have a second copy, make a third copy. That's always a good thing. And go ahead and launch iPhoto and import those photos in. What iPhoto is going to do is it's going to let you modify the color and change them and crop them and do all this stuff without destroying the original. So you actually have the original still, and they'll link them together. You have to get a little better at the software, man. You have to understand the product better, but it gives you a lot more features of sort. Also, it has built-in watermarking and exporting to the web. So you kind of have everything you need. Brian's looking at me like I'm insane.
I don't remember the watermarking in there. I do want to throw in there, just to be really clear. Right now, your photos are sitting in a folder or many folders on your hard drive. When you put them into iPhoto, iPhoto copies them. It leaves them where they were, but the photos that you work with within iPhoto are only within iPhoto. They're not connected to those original photos that are somewhere else on your hard drive in those folders that you know where they are now. And as you work on them, should you watermark them or change the color, you can always go back to the original, which is also still within iPhoto. So once you put it in the world of iPhoto, it's own world, and it keeps you from accidentally getting rid of them unless you throw your entire iPhoto library out or have a hard drive failure.
Yeah, it doesn't look like iPhoto has watermarking. That's amazing.
No, I think that's probably something you used to from the Google world.
Crop is like the one thing. I don't alter almost any of my photos, but crop is the one thing I do.
There are many different options out there for watermarking, and I'm sure a little
them,
search.
Like, taking everything I've done and all the folders, the way I have them, the way I've spent all hours and hours putting them to different categories, iPhoto will keep that.
So are you using folders to manage your categories?
Yeah.
Yeah. That what you're doing over time will become non-functional.
So much time on it.
Yeah.
Is there too much cross-referencing or what?
Well, you're currently categorizing things in folders. Let's say you have all your pictures of dogs and all your pictures of watermelons in a different folder.
Yeah.
What if you have a picture of a dog with a watermelon? What do you do?
I know.
Right?
I know.
That's what these things allow you to do. You can actually tag your photo with a watermelon and a dog tag, and then you're set. Now, I wouldn't say iPhoto is great at this. In fact, it's kind of pitiful in my mind, but it's probably better than what you're currently doing.
At what part?
At doing the managing and organization.
Yeah, it can handle tags, but it's not...
If you want to have a little better tool than what you're currently using, but still use your folder structures to organize things, I would recommend a product that comes with all the Adobe products called Bridge. I don't know how much it costs by itself, but it's called Adobe Bridge. I think that's what it's called.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it allows you to just look at your file system and all the photos in there. It'll actually make different things. You can tag them, but it keeps them all in the same folder structure you have.
And does that have the watermarking?
It might. I wouldn't be surprised if it did.
So like all the I understand that organization is important too, but
the watermarking.
I will find out momentarily. Thank you for these. Was there another question you had?
I did have another question. Whenever I open my Yahoo Mail, about 90% of the time when I go to hit reply, it's now giving me a thing that says Safari can't verify the identity of the website, it could be corrupt, and this happens once in a while on Facebook too, like once in a blue moon, and I know it's not corrupt, so
it's
why
the NSA. It's not really the NSA. There's a couple things that could be going on.
Our apologies to the NSA.
Trademark, by the way. What's most likely going on is there's a couple different things that happen. If you connect through a device that tries to handle your login and authentication. Sometimes they redirect the traffic when they do that. This is a common thing if you go to a coffee shop and you connect to the Wi-Fi.
I only use my home computer.
Sometimes you get a thing that says this is not a valid certificate.
Can't verify the identity of the website. Could be.
Is this always on the same websites? What websites are having this problem?
It's 99.99% of the time on my Yahoo Mail. Once in a while on Facebook. Like, very rarely on Facebook if it's happened once or twice. But almost, 80% of the time when I hit reply, like I'll open a Yahoo Mail to a friend that I, know really well. And it'll say that when I go to reply.
Does it pop up in a message from your whole computer, or is it just in the email message itself?
It comes kind of laid over the email message.
Okay, so that's probably a Yahoo feature where they don't share the identity of the person. Doesn't sound like a website identity problem. So the question is your computer system telling you, I don't know if it's really Yahoo that you're writing this email to, or using this web interface to, or is it Yahoo saying, I don't really know if this email address you're sending to is a real person?
It's Yahoo, I think, because it says...
So that means that it's possible that you're actually communicating with someone who's pretending to be your friend.
No. It just happened. I just tried it to, see an example before I called you. It happened on a Groupon email. I mean, it just happens most of the time now. And my husband was like, oh, it's nothing. Ignore it. Because it is. Hasn't been a problem. It's been going on for months.
Okay. It's hard for me to dissect the actual problem here. I could give you a long list of what they would be, but we'd have to go into a bit of obscurity there.
Right.
I think that the probably don't worry about it's okay there, but keep in mind that anytime you get security warnings that you ignore, you're doing something a little wrong. I'm not familiar with Yahoo's interface, why that might be occurring. There's a few different reasons. It's possible that Yahoo is running ads and the ads are actually the problem. That's a more common problem.
What would you do if you were me?
I would switch away from the Yahoo interface.
No.
but I'd probably use a mail client myself instead of the browser. But also I would know from the error message what the problem was is the trick.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to do a screen capture for it, do a screen capture, which you can do Command-Shift-4, I think, does a screen capture, or 3.
Yeah. 3. 3 does the whole screen.
Do a screen capture. Send it to geeks@geekspeak.org. I will take a look at it and tell you what the heck's going on. Okay?
Awesome.
Well, there's one other hint here. She has a husband who's a bit of a geek, and there's possibility that he's done something in the computer or the wireless network that is interfering with the certificates or something like that.
Honey.
Send that to us, and we'd love to take a look.
I guess if it was in the network, but probably not. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. And one last thing: Adobe Bridge does support watermarking in batch, and it does kind of the same kind of management that you have. It doesn't move files around; it actually uses your file system. So, I highly recommend Adobe Bridge. I'm putting a video up about watermarking. On geekspeak.org. Today's show, of course, is the.
Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for calling in.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Elizabeth. Hey, while we were chatting, Mardine wrote us at geeks@geekspeak.org and offered a solution for failing headphones. I don't know if this is following up on a previous episode, but it seems like a nice tip. We would get those little, the headphones just fall apart all the time, right? They go crackly in one ear or something. So Mardine suggests buying them from an actual store, not online, it's a fairly simple solution, keeping a receipt, and when they stop working after 3 weeks, just take them back to the store and they'll replace them immediately, and then repeat it. It means you keep using the same headphones over a period of time, but Mardine thinks that maybe this will force the stores to pressure the manufacturers to improve durability because
I agree.
There's enough of an irritation there going up the chain that it might actually create more durability in the product.
So let me ask you, Bonnie, do you keep all your receipts of your things you buy?
Never.
Do you have any system to do that?
I've got a pile on my desk where things kind of eddy.
Do you keep just the really important ones?
Yes.
If I spend over $100, I keep that receipt. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, Lyle, you have a system for this as well?
I have folders, yeah.
How much time would you say you spend trying to keep track of all that
stuff? Almost none.
Really?
Yeah.
As long as it's in the folder, then you don't have to.
Because it's not, basically the receipts go in my wallet, then when I get home, they go onto my dresser until I want to fill up my dresser, then take them all, slap them into the month that I'm in currently, and then after a year, those go into an envelope. So it would be a pain to find it. But I don't spend a lot of time managing it.
I see.
What about you? You scan everything, right?
I scan everything.
I try to do
and
it
it's incredibly time-consuming.
Oh, yeah.
That sounds good.
You should add up all that time, and then when I need to find a receipt, I'll record that amount of time it took me to find that receipt, and we'll see which one who
receipt
won.
Receipt race.
Hey, but speaking of headphones and Martine's suggestion about just take them back all the time so that they actually built them better,
yeah,
which would be great if everyone did that.
Yeah.
What about other wearable tech? This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Bonnie Jean Primsch and Brian Young. And wearable technology on Kickstarter projects. Go on, sir.
So there's a lot of wearable tech in the news going on every week. And various big companies have released some wristwatches or smartwatches, as they're calling them. But there's a couple little projects going on Kickstarter and Indiegogo that were interesting enough to mention. If you find it is something that in your life you often have moments where you want to just capture that moment, but you never realize it until after it's happened. Then maybe you're sitting and talking with a friend and you guys are chatting about some great idea and you're like, oh, I wish I could write that down really quick. A pair of guys has created something called, what's the name of it here? It's called Capture. So it is essentially a microphone.
Is it a hat?
No, it's not a hat. It's a wristwatch, and it is a recording device that's recording all the time.
Audio.
And it is made so you can keep the last minute of whatever audio is going on around you. So it's not the most stylish thing, although it may be more stylish than some. It's still
plasticky. It's got the gramophone horn.
Well, it's
2 inches by 7 feet.
But it solves one specific problem, and if you're a person that just hates that you missed those moments and you just wish you had an easy way to go back and get them, here's an audio tool to do that with.
Okay, so this whole records all the time thing, it records all the time and erases everything after a minute unless you push a button, and then it keeps that minute.
And then it sends it to your smartphone or something, and from there you can share it, you can put it in your Evernote.
This is the kind of stuff where people, when I get in an elevator and have Google Glass on, and someone goes, oh, I go, no, it's really not that bad. And then I show it to them, and afterwards we talk. And I go, you know, I could be wearing something that's recording us all the time anyway. This one's not, I don't think.
Isn't that the inherent problem with Google Glass? It's in your face.
Yes, that's the inherent problem. But yeah, there are a lot of devices like this. I think they're kind of cool. The recording what's happened and keep track of it would be so great. I know that after Geek Speak, every week, we have the best conversations following the show about all the content again. We're uninhibited. We talk, you know, smack. We swear. It's great. And about 10 minutes in, I go, why weren't we still recording this? Man.
Well, get one of those, and then we could have like a online only bonus feature.
I could, of course, turn on Glass, but then I got off to have a whole video.
Ugh. Yeah, and your batteries wear down quick.
Yeah, exactly.
So all these wearable, specific wearable technologies that just solve this specific problem are really great for these general smartwatches that may be coming out to see what uses people can apply them for. But this other device that I have here is really interesting, not for its not for its technology that's going to be put into something else, but it's a little ring, just like any other ring you wear, but it's a clock ring, and it's very stylish, and it's nicely made, and you actually can just look at your ring, and the LEDs will light up the right numbers for what time it is. It's a simple concept, but it's a...
Is it the LEDs are just dots? You have to read binary?
Seconds are dots, but for hour, it's just a number, a regular digit. And for minutes, it's got regular numbers with some hash marks in between it I'm not exactly
it's
sure
subtle.
What...
You got to learn it a little bit, but...
Yeah, yeah. You'll pick it up right away.
And but, this watch, or this ring lasts for how long? On a charge?
It has a wireless charger. I believe it said 2 days, but I may have gotten one
wrong. I think Brian's fishing for a birthday present idea. Yeah. Is this a Kickstarter project too?
This one's on Indiegogo. It is called Ring Clock. But unlike
that's a unique name.
I know. But unlike a lot of the wearable technology that I see coming out, this one's stylish. This one has some beauty to it. It's not a piece of plastic that you are not going to wear on your wrist.
Is it metal?
It's metal. Yeah, it's steel. And it is water resistant. You don't want to go swimming with it, though.
Oh, okay. Cool.
There are other wearable tech ideas in a show that Lindsay and I did back in July. I think the 27th of July. You can let it for ladies only.
Okay, will you link that show to this show page?
Sure.
And
yes,
Brian, of course, these stories that you're doing on Kickstarter, you'll put on geekspeak.org. Today's show, of course, is September 7th, 2013, and we're now going to Bob in Marina. Welcome to Geekspeak.
Oh, it's wonderful to be visiting with you again. I love it. Years ago I had an idea for a wearable thing. I called it a thinking cap that would have kind of a drop-down ocular and, you know, a little solar-powered, you know, CPU in your head. But My question for you all today, I know some of you dabble in music. I'm at the point in my lifespan of my computer where I'm looking at the frustrations of running Sonar 2 and looking at maybe what platforms and DAWs you would recommend on the Mac system. I've been looking at Logic 10, and I was wondering if you have any experience with that and how comparing that to Pro Tools.
Okay, well, so in my old role at UCSC, I was around a lot of people that were doing music stuff. A lot of people were writing their own software using Maximus P and doing their own kind of mixing, which is a programming environment. Pro Tools, Logic, and Ableton? I can't remember to pronounce that. Ableton Live. These are all packages that are used for software for music creation. But, you know, I got to say that it really depends on what you want to be doing. If you want to have multi-track mixing, then these are the type of tools you need. Is that what you're talking about, like laying down multiple tracks?
I also want to be able to be, as a performance musician, mm-hmm. I also run Guitar Rig 5 as a guitar interface. But I would also like to be able to have the DAW and all this stuff to be capable of being portable and supporting live performance. So that's where the Logic 10 environment looks like it may be one of the better suited for that, because that way it would, the bottom line is I'm real frustrated with the hardware configuration problems that you have with non-standard compliance that exists in the open source PC world versus the controlled hardware specs that Mac seems to impose that actually makes things work reliably.
Well put. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely that space where, first off, I know a DJ that, or a person that's making music all the time, and he's doing almost all the mixing and everything on a tablet, on an Android 7. What are they called? I've got one.
Nexus
7. And all of it. Recording it, mixing stuff, everything. The only time he goes to the PC is when he's rendering complex audio files where he actually needs the DDA to be a little bit better. To my mind, this is like saying, what's the best guitar to buy, right? It's you pick it up and you start using it and you try it and you see if you can afford it, and maybe you get one that you like but you want something better. You try your friend's setup and you see what they like, what's good about them, and maybe you pick up the kind of strings they're recommending. So it's more personal, I think, than this is the best software package. I don't have a good answer to that. I don't do a lot of music mixing. So I know that every time I get into one of those environments, I feel like I'm in a 3D environment where the tools are all wrong. Like, I always feel that way about sound editing. Now, I do, of course, a lot of audio editing, and I do use, because the station here uses it, Adobe Audition for editing. But this is more about analog files, right? Just cutting and slicing and remixing audio. It's not about doing full Pro Tools type work. I would say that the default go-to in most environments I've gone into is Pro Tools, and Live and Logic are, of course, better, also used. So I don't have a good thing except to say this is probably one of those situations where a meetup group makes a lot of sense, digital music meetup in Santa Cruz area. Got to say that we're in a really great place for electronic music. There's an amazing electronic music program at UCSC. There's some really great graduates that stayed in the area, and I know a lot of those people and kind of hook you up with them, but I don't think there's a good answer that's a technical answer. I think it's more about an instrument and answer. How's that?
I would love to have you maybe host a show where you could bring in some of the Apple folks that are, Logic pro guys. But once again, there's a difference between running stuff home and then actually using the stuff in a live performance environment.
And most of the artists that I know that do it live build their own tools. They build their own software tools. They do a lot of configuration themselves to make the instrument panel they want work. And that's more what I'm familiar with, is actually people hacking their own software solutions. And I could bring some people on. I could bring my friend on who has drum pants that are like an instrument that he built into his pants. Those are cool. It'd be a fun audio show. Thank you for the suggestion. I think we'll set up a show. And thanks for calling in, Bob. And good luck.
Cool.
All right. Take care.
I love you guys. Happy weekend.
Thank you.
Happy weekend. Yeah, I hear my friend Maeve's on the line.
Oh, yeah?
On line 3.
Well, Bob was on line 3, so I don't think so.
Oh, okay. Well, that's confusing. Oh, it's a lost caller.
Lost
I wonder
caller.
If Maeve will call us back. She says, or he says, there's an alternate Thursday thing.
Ooh.
They do a PGP finding. Do you know what that is?
Yes.
PGP finding.
Pretty good privacy. It's actually really good privacy. This is the way to encrypt email between each other. And this is the first offer you have to do is you have to know the authentication of people's signatures. So you get together and you say, hey, I recognize you. You're Bonnie. And somebody else says, hey, Lyle, I recognize your voice from your show. You're Lyle. So then we pass our secrets to each other. Yeah. And after we have passed the secrets, we can trust that we have the authentication. Yes, go on.
But Lyle, every time I connect to Gmail, it says it's locked. It says it's using TLS encryption.
That's
there.
Right. That's not the same thing. Gmail can actually read it. That's how they make money, by putting ads in that are related to your content. I have an interesting article, actually, that I wrote years ago explaining PGP. It's at lyle.troxel.com/PGP, and I will link to that on the show page, geekspeak.org. Today's show page, of course, is September 7th, 2013. Well, we've got room for one more quick story. Either of you have one?
Well, I could talk about there was a number of 3D printing designs for good. Some of the prize winners included vaccination beads that you could wear as like a bracelet, and you could even personalize them with the kids' initials so that in a developing world country, you can have an easy way of identifying quickly what they've already been vaccinated for and what vaccinations they might still need. That's lovely.
Because they never change bracelets.
Yeah, yeah.
Very cool. And, well, we'll link to that article. Of course, we're running out of time.
Yeah, that'll be there online.
I'm Lyle Troxa. In the air with me is Bonnie Jean Primsch and Brian Young. Answering the phones is Rick. Thank you all for participating today on GeekSpeak.
Thanks a lot.
I'm Lyle Troxa. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight. I'm sorry, registered service mark by David Lawrence and is used with permission. Everything we talk about at GeekSpeak is at geekspeak.org. Today's show is September 7th, 2013. You can ask us questions and like us on Facebook and all that stuff up from geekspeak.org. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next week here on GeekSpeak.